The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's nice to be with you. Nice to be down in the flatlands. Sit with flatland people. I have to say that with your new place in Scotts Valley, we're going to miss the IMC groups up at Jikoji. For many, many years, Gil came up, and then Andrea's been coming up, and I think it was Andrea's last time. And I saw pictures of the place in Scotts Valley. It's just gorgeous. It's outrageously gorgeous. So congratulations to you for getting that place. It's wonderful. Maybe we'll all move in with you. Well, this summer at Jikoji has been an eventful summer. We just finished with a big memorial session, meditation intensive, and a big celebration, a big party. Our teachers, it's been 10 years since the death of our founding teacher, Koban Chino Otagawa Roshi. So we had a big bash, and it was great. It was really wonderful. And lots of Koban, by the way, unlike many other teachers who stayed in a place and students came to him. He loved to travel, and so his students were in many different places. So this was a chance for all his students throughout the world, as many students in Europe as well as here in America and various places in America, came together, and we had a big celebration. That was great. And this summer also, we've had lots of ordination ceremonies. We've had four in the last month or so. And interestingly enough, they've all been women this time. All four of them are women. Three were ordained as what we call a priest. A priest ordination, a bhikkhuni priest ordination, and one as a lay ordained. It's quite a cluster for us to ordain that many people. Myself and a few other teachers, and we ordained these people. Ordination to me is a kind of awkward word, and even priest is an awkward word because they're kind of borrowed from Christianity. And everyone, I think, when we say ordained or we say priest or even when we say monk or nun, we develop a kind of concept in our mind that's based on maybe our more common cultural traditions of Christianity usually, and not necessarily Christianity, but at any rate, in our tradition, to be ordained as a layperson and to be ordained as a priest is actually we do the same ordination. It's the exact same words are spoken. We receive what's called the precepts. And I'm sure you have a precept tradition as well. Almost every Buddhist tradition has some kind of precept tradition. And so since that's been so ubiquitous at Jikoji, I thought I'd share with you tonight a little bit about our ordination process, and particularly what our precepts are, and what kind of attitude we have toward taking the precepts. We don't often think about this practice or this life that we've engaged in, meditation and so on, as a choice. But actually, it is. It's a very deliberate and intentional activity that we do. When we sat down together tonight, I could feel the kind of wonderful energy of us all being quiet together. Actually, what we did was we chose to stop for a while. And I think we sometimes, in this process, we think that the meditation process and the coming to this way of life is something that happens to us. But I think as adults, as rational human beings, that we should acknowledge that, yes, we have chosen this. We have chosen tonight to come and sit together and be quiet. And we have chosen to look at our minds, to see our breath, or see our mental functioning. I know I often find myself falling into a kind of state of what you might call receptivity or passivity as far as this practice. And when I sit down and I meditate, I wait for something to happen. And I feel like I'm not choosing. But actually, I am choosing moment by moment. And you could say, even when you sit down and you're still, you sit down in a particular way, and you sit down in a particular place, this so-called present moment, to be affected. And in the same way that, say, if you chose to sit down in the middle of a highway, you'd choose to get run over. If you weren't careful or slow. At a certain time in our spiritual path, in our spiritual way, we come to a decision to make a vow. And to say, yes, this is my way, this is my path. And almost just like getting married, we make a public statement or a public announcement, or we meet with our like-minded friends to say, yes, this is what I'm doing. And this is what I am. And I have chosen this. I have actually chosen this path. And I acknowledge this. It's a very powerful time. And this summer, it was wonderful to witness this with these various people that took these ordination vows. Even though we have chosen, say, to marry someone, our heart may already be with that person. We may already love that person. And yet at a certain time, we need to, or we wish to, acknowledge it in a more formal way and say, yeah, say to our family and friends, yes, I love you. And in the same way, when we take these precepts, we say, yes, I'm here, and I've chosen this path. I don't know. Maybe some of you feel very provisional right now, but about your practice or about your way, and that's okay. I mean, you've chosen a provisional place, but nevertheless, you're here. Only the people that have chosen to meditate usually show up in a meditation hall. Actually, strange, isn't it? Most of you, I'm sure, know that there's sort of it's called the threefold practice. There's the Sangaku, it's called in my tradition, the three learnings or the three ways. And one, they're kind of broad general categories, and each category includes the other two. The one category that we did just a moment ago is called meditation, the practice of meditation, samadhi, meditation practice. That's one way. The other is, you might be familiar with the term sila, or with ethical concerns, how we relate to others, how we relate to things, how we conduct ourselves and act in the world. And finally, knowledge or understanding, dharma. So this is the threefold practice. And just like the Satipatthana practice of mindfulness, it's like a complete survey of the human condition. It's when you do these three practices together, you're not just doing intellectual practice. You're not just doing meditation practice. You're not just doing ethics. You're doing all of them together. So what these vows have to do is to make clear to ourselves and to others around us how this meditation and how this understanding, how we choose to make it, affect our activity. So the first, in our tradition, the first avowal, the first vows that we make are actually called returnings. And sometimes the word is translated as refuge. I take refuge in Buddha. Buddha meaning not just the historical Buddha, but my own awakened nature. I actually return to or come home to my own Buddha nature, my own awakened potential. I acknowledge that. I say that that's so when I say I return to Buddha. Refuge is the root fugue means, the Latin root means to fly, like a bird. And refuge, Fugel, I think in German is fly. I think same root. To refuge, to refly, to fly back, to come back, to come back to my true nature. So I take refuge in Buddha. Or I return to Buddha. And I return to Dharma. I return to my own sounds too much. I return to the essential or the primal or the base understanding, the knowledge that is understood, the way things are. I come back to that. I fly home to my original awakened understanding. And I return to my original awakened, it's called Sangha, which means, sometimes it's translated as community, but it's community, not just our specific spiritual friends, but it's much broader than that. It means the inner connection with all beings and all things. So we say, I fly back home to I recollect that this is so, that I'm actually completely involved with every being and everything, without exceptions. I remember, I recollect that I'm unavoidably connected. I return to Sangha. I return to Buddha, to Dharma, to Sangha. So that's how it begins. And then the next set is called the pure precepts. And these are very broad precepts. And they go, I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. Very broad statement. I just, across the board, without even knowing what it is and what has to be done in a particular situation, without the specifics arising yet, nevertheless, I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. That's my intention. And I vow to embrace and sustain the good, the wholesome, what is conducive to well-being in myself and others. I vow to face that direction. And I vow to embrace and sustain all beings. Same thing as Sangha. I vow to take care of that. So these are called the pure precepts, the broad precepts. And as you can tell, it's a pretty big deal, you know? It's kind of scary when you think about it. Ouch, what have I said? What have I just said? But I have other stuff to do and I've got appointments and... Nevertheless, there's a certain time when it may happen to you that you'll say, yes, I'm ready to take these vows. And I should say, too, that a vow, in this instance, can be understood as not a promise, not saying, yes, I will be a good boy or I'll be a good girl from now on. That's kind of it's too rich. It's like too rich a meal. We start at a very kind of modest place. We say, I avow in the sense that I bring to it my intention. It's as if we're looking in a certain direction. We're habitually looking in a certain direction and we find that, no, I don't want to face that direction anymore. I actually want to shift a little bit and face this way. So we evoke an intention to shift and face in this certain way, this slightly different way. Or maybe it's a grossly different way, depending on how good or bad we've been. So those are the three pure precepts. And then after that comes what's called the ten grave precepts. And grave in the sense that things are getting really serious now. You know, they're getting more specific, and we're getting sort of down to it. You know, how we're behaving and how we intend to behave. So how they're stated is actually I'm going to read three different versions, and the first, there's many different translations of these, and again these are precepts for not just for monastic practice, but these are precepts for lay practice, for everyday practice. So they're not intended for a special situation, but they're intended for everyday situation and how we conduct ourselves in our daily life, and how we relate to other people. How we meet other people is very important. So the tenfold precepts, and these are probably similar to the precepts that you have, or the vows that you have. The first reading of it says, first, no killing life. Second, no stealing. Third, no attaching to fulfillment. This is a kind of subtle way of saying no inappropriate or harmful sexual behavior. Fourth, no illusory words, no lying. Fifth, no selling the wine of delusion. This is also translated as no intoxicating self or others. Six, no dwelling on past mistakes. This is kind of different. No dwelling on past mistakes. No dwelling on the past mistakes of others, and no dwelling on the past mistakes of yourself. No holding grudges. No holding resentment. Seventh is no praise and no blame. Other translations of this are no praising oneself and disparaging others. But my teacher, Koban Shina Roshi, translates in a much broader way. He simply says, no praise and no blame, period. No praise and no blame. No praising yourself, and no praising others. Now that's kind of odd, right? And no blaming yourself, and no blaming others. In other words, meeting a situation or meeting a person just as it is and relating to it just as it is. Don't puff it up and make it a bigger deal than it is, which is a kind of deceit. And don't disparage it. Don't undermine it. And don't undermine yourself. No praise and no blame across the board. I really like the way that Koban Shina Roshi translates this. Eighth is no hoarding materials or teachings. so in my instance, that means if I'm asked to teach, I have to teach. And sometimes I don't want to teach. And it means if you have a truth, if you're really feeling a truth, or if you really experience a truth, it's selfish not to share that truth, not to express that truth one way or another, not necessarily in words. And also things, also being generous with what you have. No hoarding materials or teachings. And ninth is no being angry. Or this is also translated as no harboring anger. And tenth is no abusing or no bringing harm to the three treasures, which is your original awakened life, your original awakened understanding, your original awakened interconnection with all things, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So, it's a big deal, isn't it? Whew! Wow. After a ceremony, these people are like, oh, what did I do? And yet, they chose to do this. This is called chetana in Sanskrit. And chetana is a really, I love Sanskrit words because they're much broader than our English words. Chetana means, it's one of the seven mental factors. Chetana means, it means volition. It means you've actually chosen something. But it also means a particular kind of clarity or consciousness that you bring to a situation, a kind of intelligence you bring to a situation in order to choose, in order to come to the place of choosing. So it means, in this chetana means arriving to choose and choosing both. I'm going to read now a completely different version of these tenfold or ten grave precepts. And if you've noticed that these ten precepts are, they say, no, don't do this, and no, don't do that. No killing life. No. And these are actually stated in a more, in the same precepts, but they're stated in a completely positive way. So these are called the clear mind precepts. In no killing life, I vow to nourish and encourage life. Completely different attitude, isn't it? In no stealing, I vow to honor all gifts, those given and those not yet given. In no attaching to fulfillment, I vow to remain faithful in relationships. In no illusory words, I vow to communicate truth. In no selling the wine of delusion, I vow to polish clarity and dispel delusion. In no dwelling on past mistakes, I vow to create wisdom, even from ignorance. In no praise, no blame, I vow to cultivate modesty in self and others, with nothing above and nothing below. In no hoarding materials or teachings, I vow to share understanding, freely giving of self. In no being angry, I vow to release bias and dwell in equanimity. and in no harming the three treasures, I vow to respect Buddha, unfold Dharma, and nourish Sangha. So, that's the other side. Those threefold precepts that I talked about before, the three pure precepts. Do you remember the first one was, I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. So that the 10 precepts where it said no killing life, no stealing, no attaching to fulfillment, and so on, those can be seen in the sense of sila, of conduct. But we can also see that, we can also see all these precepts like the clear mind precepts in the sense of doing good. So in a sense, we say we're taking 10 precepts, but actually, in a certain sense, we're taking 30 precepts. We're taking 10 precepts as, these 10 precepts as ethical vows, not to do this and not to do that. And we're taking them again in a positive sense, saying, yes, I will nourish life. And we're taking them again in a much broader sense of actually how we relate to others and how we take care of others and how we're interconnected with others. So just one additional thing I want to say about the precepts, and that's a slightly different version of the precepts, and this is called Bodhidharma's 10 precepts. And from my practice tradition, from the Zen practice tradition, Bodhidharma did an interpretation of these 10 precepts that is very, very broad. And I'm just going to read a few of them to give you a flavor of those. And this is, by the way, this is translated by Koban Shino Roshi. So the translation is a little, well, it's not your usual sense of English. It's a little different. So the first precept we have is no killing life. So first, no killing life. And this is Bodhidharma's understanding of it. Self-nature is mysteriously profound. In the midst of eternal Dharma, not even to give rise to the view of stopping and extinction is called no killing life precept. Can you get hold of that one? this is kind of radical stuff. It's so broad that it's almost hard to call it a precept or a vow. Not even to give rise to the view of stopping and extinction is called no killing life precept. So what's he talking about? We know that there's generation and extinction. We know that there's birth and death, don't we? We know we're going to die. We know the truth of impermanence. What's going on here? Not even to give rise to the view of stopping and extinction. So we say, no killing life. But what Bodhidharma is saying, he says, there is no birth. There is no origination. And there is no extinction. And he's saying to us, in the midst of birth and death, in the midst of generation and extinction, in the midst of all this transitoriness of our life, I'm asking you, Bodhidharma is asking you, the vow is asking you, to also have the view of no origination and no extinction. How does that go? We live and we die. We live and we die, don't we? Or do we? Can we also hold a bigger view that says no birth and no death? Is there one life, one interconnected, totally involved life, and it has no origination and no extinction? Is that what he's talking about? And in the midst of birth and death, can we hold this view? Can we keep this view? Or not give rise to the view of stopping and extinction for once? Or when he says, no illusory words. Self-nature is mysteriously profound, unexplainable dharma. Not even to say one word is called no illusory words. I've already said too much. Huh? How's the time? Is it good? Okay, good. Really, we know we can lie. We know we can deceive. We believe, or we imagine that we can deceive another person or ourselves. But actually, in the process of lying, of obscuring the truth as we imagine it, aren't we totally confessing the truth of our deception? Aren't we totally being true to our fear or our need to be approved, or whatever impetus propelled us to speak an untruth or to not completely say the truth? Haven't we totally confessed ourselves completely every time we open our mouths? So what Bodhidharma is saying in these other versions of the precepts is, yes, there's no killing life. Yes, cherish life. And yes, also keep this very big view where there's one life that's totally interconnected, and it has no origination, and it has no extinction. And you can keep that view in the midst of birth and death. And that can be part of your vow. Anyway, that's the proposition. When people come forward and say, yes, this is my path. So this summer at Jikoji, we had a good dose of vows. And what's very interesting about the vows is that not only the people that's come forward and take the vows, but everyone kind of remembers the vows with them. It's very wonderful. So, yes, did you want to ask something?
Thank you very much. It seems to me if one looks at the plant world, no tree ever dies in that sense. A new one is never born from nowhere. It's always like one long, continuous chapter in a long, long book. That it's all continuous in a way. Is that correct?
Yeah, I see your point. In Bodhidharma's trees, huh? And plants, yeah. And our ancestors too, you know, live in us as well. Anyone else like to say anything? Oh, yeah.
I'm not as familiar with the vows in the Zen tradition, but I have heard the Bodhisattva vows, so I thought that was part of it, or is that not part of it? Or that's actually Tibetan, maybe?
The Bodhisattva vows are a kind of Tibetan version of the same thing.
Okay, yeah. So that's not included in Zen.
These are Bodhidharma from the tradition, yeah. But it's all, you know, they're all one vow. Yeah. Yeah. Just be nice. That's the vow. And behave yourself. Oh, it's hard. Because, you know, we've all got little rascally kids within ourselves, even though we're trying to be adults, and all us angels have demons in there. Yeah, nevertheless, here we are.
I have a problem with carrying things too far. Is this on? Oh, okay. Where you're trying to preserve human life and there are pests around that carry vectors and things, you know. And I value human life above the life of the disease or the vectors. You see what I mean? And I understand the heart of it, or the wish of it, but the actual being able to carry it out completely seems impossible.
Of the vow of no killing life.
No killing life, because...
No killing life, yeah.
Well, maybe you can't even kill life. I don't know.
Actually, it's totally irrational from a particular point of view. We kill to live. I mean, in order to eat, in order to survive, yeah. We walk on the dead. We do. And the next generation will walk on us. You know,
So, how do you approach that? I heard the word sentient beings used before.
That's kind of our bias, isn't it? Because we happen to be sentient.
But we're going to eat carrots and we're going to die.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's an impossible vow.
I just drop back on my breath and say, okay, I can't do that. You know, do your best, but you can only go so far.
When you think of all the smaller organisms or the parts of our body that make us up, that have their own agendas that we read about, you know, the mitochondria and so on, that are actually not, you know, they're us and they're not us at the same time. So it's like the whole sense of self, or the whole sense of a this idea that we have of a individual, unique self is just a kind of policy that we walk around with, and it's provisional, you know, and it is temporary. So in the midst of that, the question comes up for us, because we're at this place of consciousness, of awareness, how to take care of the situation as best we can.
As best, that's what
as
I do.
As best we can.
As
yeah.
best you can.
Yeah.
thank you very much. Very informative. In alignment with what this gentleman said, I've been trying not to kill the spiders in my place.
Yes.
And they bite me left and right. So today I was trying to get rid of four of them, pick them up, and let them go. It's a very difficult thing. And I have problem with, I cannot understand the difference between a tree is a living thing. And is it sentient, a tree? I don't know.
Some people say there's a sentientness.
We eat plants.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's lots of confusion in that realm for me.
There's a big gray area in what is sentient and what isn't. And you could even make an argument that a rock is sentient because it responds to stimulus, you know, water or, you know. So, but I don't know. I talk to rocks sometimes. It's when they start to talk back that I get worried.
Yeah, this is where I am at this moment.
Thanks for taking care of the spiders, by the way. They enjoyed you. It's a big topic, and we're never finished with this sense of how to exist, how to be in relationship, how to make our words true, impeccable, wholesome, how to make our actions useful, kind, helpful. Well, we start right here, and we are those who are choosing to look at this, that are actually practicing chetana, choice, volitional activity. We're choosing to sit down and look at our own minds. We're choosing to place ourselves in the midst of birth and death, and in the midst of no birth and no death, together. We're choosing to be conscious, to see our minds, to practice. So let's continue the work together, okay?